From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
What is going on in Darfur, the Sudan, now is a lesson in colonialism and what it does. It's a lesson in racism and what it does. It's a lesson in what needs to be done by people of what Dr. King called the beloved community.
Former D.C. Congress member Walter Fauntroy is arrested in a protest at the Sudanese embassy. This as Colin Powell goes to Darfur to deal with the humanitarian crisis. We'll also go to the Sudan. Prime Minister Yvonne Neptune is arrested in Haiti. We'll take a look at the campaign of terror under the new Haitian regime with Congressmember Maxine Waters and the brother of a U.S. citizen executed in front of his own family in Haiti. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's High Court has ruled Israel must reroute part of its massive wall through the West Bank because portions would cut off tens of thousands of Palestinians from their jobs, schools, and farms. The court ruled the wall, quote, injures the local inhabitants in a severe and acute way while violating their rights under humanitarian and international law. The ruling affects a 19-mile section of the wall near Jerusalem, but opens up challenges to other portions of the structure, which will eventually stretch for 400 miles through the occupied territory. Israel says the wall is a necessary security measure, but Palestinians view it as the apartheid wall. Palestinian Prime Minister Ahmed Korey praised the ruling but said the whole wall should be torn down. He said, quote, it's a racist separation wall and therefore it should fall. He said there is no other alternative. The International Court of Justice is scheduled to also rule on the legality of the wall, which is largely built on Palestinian land. The court's expected to rule on July 9th. Saddam Hussein remains in a U.S.-run jail today, but the new Iraqi government has taken legal custody of the former Iraqi president. He's expected to be arraigned today in Iraqi court alongside 11 other top officials. Some Republicans in Congress are urging the U.S. to back a swift trial of Saddam Hussein before the November election. Republican Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania says putting a spotlight on Saddam's record of execution and torture could help shore up public support for the invasion damaged by the U.S. prison abuse scandal. The New York Times has found the U.S. has been far behind its scheduled plans for rebuilding Iraq. Of the 2,300 promised construction projects, only 140 are underway. News reports indicate that the Marine Corporal Wasif Ali Hassoun, who's being held hostage in Iraq, may have been attempting to desert the military when he was abducted. Hassoun may have been trying to flee to Lebanon, where he was born. About 2 months ago, Hassoun told a cousin that several U.S. deserters had escaped by bribing Iraqis to help get them out of the country. Meanwhile, new congressional report has found the desertion rate in some units of the newly formed Iraqi security forces run up as high as 80%. The report by the General Accounting Office calls into question how prepared Iraq is to handle security following the so-called handover of power. The report read, quote, Iraqi security forces proved unready to take over security responsibility from the multinational force as demonstrated by their collapse during April 2004. The father of the U.S. contractor who was beheaded last month in Iraq blasted the Bush administration in London. Michael Berg, whose son Nicholas was killed, said, quote, people like George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld don't see the pain that people have to bear. They don't know what it feels like to have your guts ripped out. What I'm trying to do is show the American people and the British people that war has a wretchedly horrible face, he said. The New York Times today chronicles the story of a Nepalese man who spent 3 months in solitary confinement before being deported, largely because he accidentally videotaped a building in Queens that contained an FBI office. He was arrested and then detained because he'd overstayed his tourist visa. Soon he was in solitary confinement. 3 months later, he was deported, even after FBI investigators confirmed that the man was harmless. Post-9/11 rules by the Justice Department made it near impossible for the FBI to clear the man of wrongdoing. One FBI investigator even reached out to the Legal Aid Society of New York for help in dealing with the case, but it was to no avail. In order to free the man, the FBI would have been forced to secure signatures from high-level anti-terrorism officials in Washington. When that didn't happen, he was deported. Meanwhile, a Pakistani immigrant detained almost 3 years ago is now scheduled to be deported. He was first picked up October 2001 for taking photographs of an upstate New York reservoir in the Catskill Mountains. Ansar Mahmoud lost his final appeal yesterday. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld the right of foreigners to sue in U.S. courts for human rights abuses and violations of international law under the 18th century Alien Tort Statute. But the justices attempted to narrow the interpretation of the 200-year-old law. The ruling marks a defeat for the Bush administration and business community. Also yesterday, the Supreme Court blocked a law requiring internet filters on public computers in order to prevent children from seeing online pornography. The court ruled that such measures can stifle free access to information. 24 UN workers died yesterday after their plane crashed in Sierra Leone. Before the crash, 137 UN peacekeeping troops had already been killed in Sierra Leone. And the Los Angeles Times is reporting the Bush administration is now considering moving hundreds of detainees held at Guantanamo Bay to prisons within the United States. This comes a day after the Supreme Court granted the detainees access to U.S. courts. Music of Haitian singer Soane. She's in prison in Haiti. We'll hear more about her case as well as the imprisonment of the Haitian Prime Minister, Van Neptune. But first, we're looking at the Sudan. I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of you listening in, viewing in, or listening in, streaming on the internet over www.democracynow.org.
Well, Secretary of State Colin Powell yesterday threatened Sudan with unspecified UN Security Council action if it failed to crack down on militias that have killed tens of thousands of black Africans in the western Darfur region and made more than a million people homeless in the past 15 months alone. Criticized for responding too slowly to the crisis and under pressure from Congress, Powell traveled to Khartoum yesterday in the highest-level visit to the Sudan by the U.S. more than two decades. Powell met with President Omar Hassan Ahmed al-Bashir, warning him to end the attacks by the militias, provide full access for humanitarian aid, restart political talks with rebel groups, and allow more international ceasefire monitors into the region.
The Sudanese government has repeatedly denied there is mass suffering in Darfur. The UN has described the situation as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world today. A senior U.S. official recently told Reuters that up to 1 million displaced Sudanese could die this year in Darfur refugee camps because of government-backed Arab militias having razed villages, burned crops, and destroyed water sources. En route to Sudan, Powell told Reuters, quote, people are dying, the death rate is going to go up significantly. We see indicators and elements that would start to move you toward a genocidal conclusion, but we're not there yet.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan arrived in Khartoum as Colin Powell left the Sudanese capital to visit Darfur for a few hours. U.S. officials and aid workers said they expected Sudanese authorities to try to mask the reality on the ground there, where hundreds of thousands of people are malnourished and face spreading disease in many of the overcrowded camps. We're going to go to Sudan in a minute, but we're joined on the phone by Reverend Walter Fontroy. He's a former Congress member from Washington, D.C., one of the founders of the Congressional Black Caucus in 61. Martin Luther King appointed him to be director of the Washington Bureau of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and the UN helped to organize the 1963 March on Washington. Walter Fontroy was arrested at the Sudanese embassy yesterday in Washington. Why, Walter Fontroy?
I was arrested for the purpose of raising public consciousness and pricking the conscience of enough people to force a change in public policy. I did it on Thanksgiving Eve in 1984 as a member of Congress, and we launched the Free South Africa movement, and we're hoping that people of conscience all over the world will begin to assemble at Sudanese embassies in their countries, demanding that this lying, deceit and criminal genocide being visited upon the blacks of Sudan stop.
And Walter Fontroy, for those who are not familiar with the situation there, what are the contours of the conflict there, and how is it developed?
You need to understand three things about what's going on the ground in Darfur. The first is you have to understand colonialism, which has had its purpose to drive native people off of valuable land, land rich with diamonds and gold and ferromanganese and precious metals and so forth, onto reservations where they maintain them in poverty as a source of cheap labor to bring over to extract the wealth. They did that in Africa 500 years ago, began doing it. When they discovered a new world, something called the Americas, they came over and drove the natives, Red Indians, off the land. If they had not killed as many Indians as they did in this hemisphere, there would be more Red Indians on this continent than in than there are Chinese in China. They did it. They drove them off. They put them on reservations, and they invited, in a racist orientation, whites from Europe to come and gave them the land in something called the Homestead Act. They said, we're not going to plow the ground and clear the woods and plant the crops. So they had Arabs to go south in sub-Saharan Africa and take the blacks and sell them into slavery. And if, so if you understand, that's what's going on here, taking the land. 20 years ago, they discovered that there was under the ground where the blacks in southern Sudan live, an ocean of oil, and under that, an ocean of water. And Chevron began to explore for it, and people who use race and religion as an excuse to take land killed Chevron employees, and Arab Muslim companies were brought in and have been extracting the wealth and driving the blacks, women, men, and children off the land, killing the men, raping the women, and taking them north and making them slaves, and telling the blacks, we are helping you to become like us, lighter. secondly, you need to understand racism itself, which, simply put, is the thesis that there are two groups of people in the world: white people, who are obviously superior, and non-white people, who are obviously inferior. They divide the non-whites into two groups: the wannabe whites and the blacks. And with them, they play a gang-counter-gang strategy. They say to the wannabes, "You're different from them. Let's you and them fight while we laugh all the way to the bank." And so the Arabs who are there killing blacks and driving them off the valuable land, first in southern Sudan and now in western Sudan, are acting out that madness. Finally, the way to deal with it is the way Martin Luther King Jr. and people of conscience and people who listen to Democracy Now! Understand. And that is, all life is precious, and we are all brothers and sisters, and we got to act like it. We've got to have people of every race, creed, and color rise up and say it's wrong and it's got to stop. That's what we did yesterday. I wish you could have been in front of the Sudan embassy yesterday afternoon, morning and afternoon, when there were Jews, Christians, Muslims, black and white together, young people, old people, saying, "Stop it." And we are saying to a deceitful, lying leadership in Khartoum, what a fellow explained to me on the march that I was organizing in 65 from Selma to Montgomery. We were walking along, and the guy said, "You know, the way the FBI is treating us down here reminds me of this this woman who caught her husband in the act of adultery." And the man said, "Don't you believe your lying eyes." Bottom line is, those cats, excuse me for using that expression, over there had the nerve to be saying to a world that sees it, there's no genocide, there's no suffering, that we have a problem with the rain. Lying. And the only way that's going to change is for us to keep on keeping on. They ignored the fact.
Reverend Walter Fauntroy, how many people were arrested yesterday in front of the Sudan embassy?
Just two of us were arrested. Joe Madison, the Black Eagle here in Washington, and myself. And we are implementing what we did in 1984. We're asking people to come every day. And therefore, Charlie Rangel will be there tomorrow to be arrested, as he was right after I was arrested in 1984. We're going to get members of the Congress to come. We're going to get highly visible Christians, Jews, Muslims to come and present their bodies and say, "Stop it."
I wanted to go now to Sudan, to Omdurman, Sudan. Ghassim Badri joins us on the line right now, president of Afad University for Women. Can you describe what is happening on the ground right now?
Thank you. What's happening, what happened before, actually, war in Darfur is a political as well as a social one. The Darfurians, they have been crying for a long time for development of area. And therefore, we are talking about an area as big as France. So it's not a small area. And it is composed of varied ethnic groups. All of these ethnic groups are indigenous population of Darfur, and they have not been coming here in the last years or so. They have been living there for long periods of time, hundreds of years. And there has been some problems between them. And the war there in Darfur now is a political there is a political part of it, which is the what the government calls the rebels, and these are taking up arms against the government because they think that the government has neglected Darfur for a long time, and they have not made any kind of development in that part.
We're speaking to Ghassim Badri in Sudan, the president of Afad University for Women. I wanted to ask you about a piece in today's Washington Post that talks about rape by the Arab militias being used as a weapon of ethnic cleansing, the quote, "We want to make a light baby." Can you respond to that?
Well, I don't think it is like that. There is this kind of rape, yes. There is this kind of enslavement, yes, and this has been going on between the tribes for a long time. But it is not now. People are talking about genocide because genocide took place in Africa. We have the example of Rwanda and Burundi, and people now are afraid that this may spill over to Darfur, and that's why people are trying to say to the government, you better act quickly before things get out of hands completely. Our government, unfortunately, did not pay attention as early as possible to the crisis in Darfur, and they concentrated on the crisis in southern Sudan. But the way that the government went about solving the problem in the southern Sudan is talking to the rebels, so-called rebels, that is the SPLA, and neglecting all other parts. So the example is, or the lesson that other people understood is that if you want to get your things in this country, if you want to get your rights in this country, you have to take up arms. And this is, I think, the political mistake that was done by the government, as well as by the IGAD, and the way that the negotiations between the government and SPLA took place, because they neglected all other Sudanese in those negotiations.
Ghassim Badri, we have to go to break. President of Afad University for Women speaking to us from Omdurman, Sudan. And when we come back, we will also be joined by a reporter with the Financial Times. And we're going to look at U.S. policy towards Sudan. After that, we're going down to Haiti and investigate the imprisonment of the Prime Minister, Yvan Neptune, and the killing of a Haitian American. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Also want to let you know to tune in throughout the summer as we bring you extended coverage during the Democratic and Republican convention. Democracy Now! Will expand to 2 hours to bring you the reporting from the streets and in the suites around the conventions. Well, we're talking about Sudan right now. We are on the line from Sudan with Ghassim Badri, president of Afad University for Women, Reverend Walter Fauntroy, retired congressmember, Washington, D.C., who was just arrested in front of the Sudan embassy yesterday in D.C., protesting what is happening there, considered the greatest humanitarian crisis in the world today. And David White joins us on the line from London, a reporter for the Financial Times. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Yes, I'd like to start with David White. Could you talk to us a little bit about the U.S. Government's role vis-a-vis the Sudanese government and the role of the United States right now in that conflict?
What is strange about this particular conflict is it comes at a time when the U.S. was actually mending relations with Sudan. 6 years ago, Sudan was considered a home of terrorists, and the U.S. actually bombed a factory outside the capital, Khartoum. Since then, things have really been getting better, especially with a provisional peace accord in the long civil war with the South. And then Darfur erupts, partly to do with the war in the South, because here was a group of people that were that felt that they were left out of the deal. A rebel movement came out. And there's been this brutal repression and the failure of the Khartoum authorities to do anything about it. This puts the State Department in a bit of a fix, because on the one hand, it's trying to tempt Sudan back into the mainstream, into the international mainstream, dealing with the rest of the world, lifting sanctions and everything like that. On the other hand, you have a growing, if somewhat belated, uproar about what's happening in Darfur.
And I'd like to ask also former Congressman Fauntroy, there's an article in the Christian Science Monitor today which talks about other possible goals of the Bush administration and of Colin Powell's visit. And it says, if the Bush team can bring Sudan back into the family of nations, as it did this week with Libya, it would gain a diplomatic victory for the war on terror. It could also fire up its Christian conservative base by securing a peace deal in Sudan's other war, a 21-year-old conflict between the Muslims in the north and a largely Christian population in the south. Your view of the reasons why Colin Powell is there today and the new attention of the Bush administration?
There's oil under the ground in Sudan, and we need it. And you can't understand what happened in the Tutsi-Hutu gang counter-gang strategy that is happening here. And that is to get control of valuable land. The purpose of the dismantling of the Congo was to get control for the mining interest, many of them based in England, sir, of the land there, particularly eastern Congo. The purpose here is to give access, get access for the West to oil that has been primarily commandeered by the Muslim Arab world. And those two factors dictate that we must, in order to avoid what Amy Chua has called a world on fire, we've got to get people with some good sense to resolve that conflict, share the wealth with the blacks of the south and the Arabs of the north into the Sudan in a fashion that we deal with the poverty, which is always the cause of these kinds of gang counter-gang strategies.
Also, the role of John Danforth, and now the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, who was the envoy to Sudan, and the forces that he represents, Reverend Fauntroy.
No question. First of all, he was appointed because I chained myself with Joe Madison to the door of the Sudan embassy 2 years ago, and we raised enough with people of conscience around the world attention to it that the president appointed John Danforth, a senator, former senator, to work out the a peace negotiation. They did that. And as soon as we thought we were getting somewhere in the north-south thing, where the rationale was that there are Christians and animists down there, and we must that they're infidels, we must teach them and remove them. Now they're going after black Muslims in the West. They're black Muslims. They are Muslims, fellow Muslims in Darfur. And so you skip these greedy, self-seeking and hypocritical people of their rationale. It's religion, it's race, it's nothing, it's money, it's oil.
We want to thank you all for being on the line with us. We've been speaking with Reverend Walter Fauntroy, who was arrested outside the Sudan embassy and calling on many others to protest there, says Congressmember Charlie Rangel of New York will be there tomorrow in a chain of protest as Colin Powell goes to the Sudan. We've also spoken with David White of the Financial Times and Ghassim Badri, president of Afad University for Women in Omdurman, Sudan. As we turn now south to the issue of Haiti, Haitian Prime Minister Yvan Neptune was arrested on Sunday after living in hiding since the March 12th installation of the new U.S.-backed interim prime minister, Gerard Latortue. Neptune is being detained at a prison in the capital, Port-au-Prince. In an interview from his prison cell on Tuesday with the Associated Press and two Haitian radio stations, Neptune said he has no confidence in the new Haitian leaders who allowed his home to be looted and burned after the removal of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Aristide says he was the victim of a modern-day kidnapping in the service of a coup d'etat backed by the United States.
Neptune says he went into hiding when Latortue was installed 3 days before he agreed to step down as prime minister and was told, quote, by official sources that there were people in a position of power who were trying to harm me. He was barred from leaving Haiti along with some 40 ex-officials. He surrendered after learning there was a warrant for his arrest. The arrest is connected with the killings of anti-Aristide gang members on February 9th. Authorities have yet to list charges, and Neptune insists that he is innocent. In the cell next to Neptune is Jocelyn Privert, the interior minister under Aristide, who said he hadn't seen a judge since being detained in April on similar accusations. At least five other Aristide officials are in the same prison.
Since President Aristide's removal, the new U.S.-backed Haitian regime has unleashed a campaign of terror, particularly against supporters of Aristide's Lavalas party. One report from the National Lawyers Guild said that 1,000 bodies have been dumped in a mass grave by the state morgue in March. Today, we take a look at some of the stories in the new Haiti, from Prime Minister Yvan Neptune to the arrest of a prominent Haitian singer and voodoo priestess, Annette Auguste, known as Soane, to the murder of a U.S. citizen, Cassie Auguste. We begin with Congressmember Maxine Waters, who denounced the arrest of Neptune, calling it, quote, part of a politically motivated campaign to arrest and intimidate Lavalas members. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Congressmember Waters.
Thank you, and thank you for giving some time and attention to Haiti. I wish the corporate media would do the same thing. Poor Haiti is forgotten, and while the United States nor the corporate media is paying any attention to what's going on, perhaps not caring what is going on, we have this campaign that is being run by this new puppet government, where they are either jailing or killing Lavalas Party's members and people that were close to President Aristide. It is absolutely ridiculous that they have arrested the real Prime Minister, Neptune. They should be arresting the killers who were part of the coup d'etat. Guy Philippe is still running around up in Cape Haitian and the north there someplace, Ganive. You know, Louis Jodel Chamblain pulled this cute little trick with this puppet government, pretending that he was turning himself in. And I understand that he's out at night drinking beer. And Jean Tatoune is still running loose. All of the killers that were involved in the coup d'etat and the threats to President Aristide. What is happening in Haiti is shameful. The world is not paying any attention. The United States, who had a hand in the removal of President Aristide, is doing nothing, not lifting a finger to this kind of injustice that's taking place now. I did release a letter, a press release, and a letter to Colin Powell that I'm sending to ask them to do something about this reign of terror. It is absolutely outrageous.
And Congressmember Waters, in terms of the situation on the ground for the Haitian people, has there been any kind of improvement in the economic situation, the daily life of the Haitian people?
No, it is absolute crisis and chaos in Haiti. You know, poor people are even poorer. They don't have jobs. You know, people in City Soleil and Bel Air and places are still being killed. They're without safe drinking water. It is absolutely in crisis. And with the floods that they just experienced, it is just absolutely devastating.
We're talking with U.S. Congressmember Maxine Waters, who was part of a small delegation in mid-March, along with TransAfrica founder Randall Robinson and a member of the Jamaican Parliament, Sharon Hay Webster, and President Aristide's lawyer, Eric Kurzban, chartered a plane to retrieve the Aristides from the Central African Republic, where they had been brought in a plane, U.S. plane, with U.S. military and security. President Aristide saying he was kidnapped in a coup backed by the United States. Now the Organization of American States is saying they have launched an inquiry into what happened to President Aristide, who first went to Jamaica and now is living in South Africa as he decides his next move. Juan?
Yes, the reports coming out of Haiti, Congressmember Waters, have talked about the Lavalas movement not being able to decide whether to continue to press for the return of President Aristide or to begin dealing with a new type of resistance within the new government. Your sense of how the popular movement there will be proceeding or is proceeding right now?
Well, I think some of those reports are correct, that there are problems with the attack on leadership. It is very difficult for the masses to be able to come to conclusions about exactly what to do. They know exactly what they're doing when they attack the strong leaders of Lavalas. This leaves the party in disarray. People are not happy about this new puppet government. They do not wish necessarily to participate with them, with this illegitimate government. On the other hand, it has not been decided what to do and how to do it, whether or not there should be just a continued resistance movement. So there is some indecision in the rank and file and the masses of the Lavalas Party. And that's exactly what this puppet government wants to do. I understand that the CIA is down there, and the CIA is down there supposedly there to help organize political activity. And so I don't know if this is a part of the CIA activity or what, but I do know that with the arrests, that some of which you identified, Soanne and Yvonne Neptune, that's what they intend, to weaken the leadership so that there will be this disarray.
We're talking to Congressmember Maxine Waters. We've been playing the music of Soanne, a Haitian American, a Haitian singer, lived in the United States for many years in Brooklyn, New York, who is now in prison, as well as Yvonne Neptune, the Haitian Prime Minister. Can you tell us about her case, why she has been arrested?
Well, you know, this was very, very startling and disturbing. Military or the police, so-called police, came to her place along with United States Marines, and they literally blasted her gates that's in front of the home. They killed the dog. They went in and they handcuffed a 5-year-old, a 14-year-old, and other adults in that complex, or two houses, Soanne's house and her sister's house, and they carted them off to jail, and then they released everybody except Soanne. I called both the American ambassador down there and the head of the Southern Command, General Hill, to find out what was going on. General Hill said to me that, yes, they had been involved. They had the warrant was issued by the Haitian government, and that the Marines went down and blasted the home with grenades, I believe it was, because they had some evidence that SOAN had been involved in activities threatening United States Marines. I asked him exactly what was that supposed to have been, and he could not tell me. He said that it was classified, that he could not give me that information. Then I heard that they were arresting her because she was involved in a confrontation up at the university that has become one of the stories told about the incidents leading up to the coup d'etat, where I guess the dean or professor up at the university had been harmed. So there have been two different stories about why SOAN was arrested, but those people who know and understand who she is and how powerful she is really believe that, again, that's the campaign of intimidation and terror, getting rid of the strong heads of Lavalas. She was close to President Aristide, well respected by Haitians. It was a woman who had dedicated her life to helping to take care of the poor. She is a singer, a creative person, and just the kind of person that people would rally behind. So again, in destroying the Lavalas movement, they are arresting, jailing, and killing the strong leaders.
We're talking to U.S. Congressmember Maxine Waters about the situation in Haiti. We're going to break with some music from the Haitian musician, singer, SOAN. And then when we come back, we're going to, in addition to Congressmember Maxine Waters, talk with a labor leader of the Bay Area who's just been in Haiti and interviewed the mayor of Milo, another member of the Lavalas Party who has been in hiding since President Aristide was ousted. He is fearing for his life. Stay with us. SOAN, the Haitian singer named Annette Auguste, known to the world as SOAN, who is now in prison in Haiti, arrested in May. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez, still on the line with us, Congressmember Maxine Waters. Also, David Welsh joins us, labor leader from the Bay Area, who recently returned from Haiti as part of a delegation with the San Francisco Labor Council investigating labor issues there. He interviewed the mayor of Milo, who has been in hiding since President Aristide was ousted at the end of February. David Welsh, welcome. Can you tell us his story?
Right. We went down to Haiti as part of a labor religious delegation at the invitation of the Confederation of Haitian Workers. And one of the things that we did was we went up to the north of Haiti to the town of Cap-Haitien, and then we drove down to Milo, which is a small peasant community not far from there. This is the area that's controlled. That was controlled very heavily by the paramilitary forces, the death squad forces of Guy Philippe, and still is. And we interviewed Moise. I had met him before when I was in Haiti in 1997 with a Pastors for Peace delegation. And so we knew each other. We interviewed him. I was there with Sister Maureen from the East Bay Sanctuary Covenant out here in the Bay Area, and we interviewed him. He was still in hiding, but he told us about the bloody repression that happened in the week following the coup, preceding the coup, when Guy Philippe's forces rampaged across the northern part of Haiti. And he told us about the many bodies that had been, of people who had been killed, and the bodies were thrown in the sea. And fishermen who were fishing off the coast would find these bodies in the week following the coup. Every day they'd come up with more bodies. And they were filling the morgues. The National Lawyers Guild sent a delegation to Haiti, and they investigated the numbers of bodies that were showing up in the morgues. And they were, normally there would be 30 or 40 bodies in a morgue. This time it would be 800 or 1,000 bodies in a morgue. The people were so concerned about the number of bodies that were turning up in the water off the coast of Cap-Haitien that they stopped eating the fish. This is Moise Jean-Charles, one of the grassroots leaders. You know, there were 7,000 Lavalas grassroots leaders who were elected in Haiti. And not only you have a large city would have a mayor, but a small district would have a mayor. These were people responsive to the people, who were trusted by the people. It was a form of grassroots organization that was happening throughout Haiti. In fact, some of the labor people that we met were also members of grassroots organizations in every corner of Haiti.
David Walsh, I'd like to ask you about the labor leaders. What is the situation with the labor movement? Because obviously there were many industrialists and merchants who were part of the move to oust President Aristide. And what is the situation now with the labor movement that you were looking at versus what was the conditions prior to this this coup?
Well, the situation is much worse for workers. The unemployment is approximately 70%, according to most estimates. People just don't have enough to eat. You talk about union dues. I mean, here in this country, we pay union dues so that people can represent the membership. If in a situation where you have 70% employment, you can imagine that these unions are also very poor. One of the groups of people we talked to were the members of the Assembly Workers and Manufacturing Workers Union, and they represent workers in the sweatshops. And they had visited with workers from the sweatshops of André Appel in the Port-au-Prince area, making electronic products, garments for the U.S. market and elsewhere. And they said the conditions there are terrible. There's no union in any of André Appel's sweatshop. Now, André Appel is a U.S. citizen who was the instigator or one of the prime movers behind the Group 184, which helped to organize the preparations for the coup d'etat when President Aristide was kidnapped by United States forces and forced out of the country. So it's very interesting that... And he had opposed President Aristide's doubling of the minimum wage to 70 good per day, which is about $1.90. And so you see a confluence of interest between these sweatshop owners and other members of the tiny Haitian elite and their direct material interest and the coup d'etat, which overthrew the government of the person, Aristide, who represented the interests of the masses of Haiti.
David Welsh, labor leader in the Bay Area, went as part of a delegation to Haiti with the San Francisco Labor Council, also talking with us about the young mayor, Moïse, renowned in Haiti for organizing small farmer cooperatives, and for Milo's radio station, RVPM, 100.3 FM, the radio voice of the peasants of Milo, which reaches some half a million Haitians who is in hiding right now. Finally, as we wrap up, and we only have about 30 seconds before we move on to London to a report just out about what's happened to billions of dollars the U.S. sent to Iraq. Congressmember Maxine Waters, the OAS launching this inquiry. What's happening in the U.S.? And you're, of course, a Democratic congressmember in the U.S. Congress. What is the candidate for president, Democratic candidate, John Kerry, saying about Haiti right now?
Well, first of all, I'm really pleased about the OAS investigation, and we can credit CARICOM for that. CARICOM has been very strong. They stood up and they insisted on an investigation in OAS, despite the fact they were being intimidated by Condoleezza Rice and others who do not want an investigation. The United States was opposed to the investigation by the OAS, and they got outvoted. And so I'm very pleased that CARICOM persisted in that, and that that appears to be taking place. Nothing is happening in the Congress of the United States. All of our committees are controlled by Republicans, as you know. They refuse to take up this issue in our committees. Nothing is going on in our Foreign Relations Committee, in the Judiciary Committee, nowhere. As a matter of fact, all that we see from afar is Zeb Bush out of Florida going into Haiti, pretending that he's concerned about the Haitian people, when in fact he does nothing to encourage the ability of Haitians who are in the United States to stay because of the terror that's going on in Haiti. And of course, he and his brother, the President of the United States, were absolutely harsh in not allowing Haitians to escape the island at its worst point of terror that was going on, turning people back at sea, and folks whose stay in the United States is running out, who would like to be able to stay and not go back to this crisis at this time. He's doing nothing to help, but he's going down there talking about putting together a commission and some kind of town hall meeting. Now, if people pay close attention to what Zeb Bush is doing, I am going to predict that he is in cahoots with Andy Apaid. They're going to try to open up plants down there for cheap labor, and he's going to bring his industrialist friends in to exploit the Haitian people one more time. Zeb Bush does not care about the well-being of the Haitian people, neither does his brother. Nothing is going on in the Congress of the United States, and a blind eye is being turned to the fact that this puppet government, which was installed by the United States, has the audacity to be jailing innocent people while Guy Philippe and Jean Tantoune and the real killers are still running around killing people.
Congressmember Maxine Waters, we just have 10 seconds, but John Kerry, has he made any other than a straw?
No, he simply said that at first he said he was against a democratically elected president being ousted from office, but then I'm told he said someplace that should he be reelected, he would not support returning Aristide to Haiti. So I've not heard anything more than that coming out of the mouth of John Kerry.
U.S. Congressmember Maxine Waters, David Welsh of the San Francisco Labor Council, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We'll continue to follow the story, and you can see our special reporting on Haiti over the last months on our website at democracynow.org, as Democracy Now! Traveled with Congressmember Maxine Waters and others to the Central African Republic when they picked up the Aristides and brought them back to this hemisphere. As we move now to our last segment, Juan.
Yes, the Bush administration handed over power to Iraq without having properly accounted for what it has done done with some $20 billion of Iraq's own money. This, according to a new report published Monday by Christian Aid, a leading British charity. The report points out that the May 2003 UN resolution giving the Coalition Provisional Authority the right to spend Iraqi oil revenue required the creation of an international oversight board, which would appoint an auditor to ensure that the funds were spent to benefit the Iraqi people.
Instead, the U.S. installed and the auditor didn't, the U.S. stalled and the auditor didn't begin work until April 2004. Even then, according to an interim report, it faced, quote, resistance from the CPA staff. Now, with the audit still unpublished, the CPA has been dissolved. New York Times columnist Paul Krugman writes, quote, think of it this way. Given the Arab world's suspicion that we came to steal Iraq's oil, the occupation authorities had every incentive to expedite an independent audit that would clear Halliburton and other U.S. companies of charges that they were profiteering at Iraq's expense, unless, that is, the charges are true. We go now to London, and Thea Lawson on the line, one of the authors of Christian Aid's new report titled Fueling Suspicion, the Coalition and Iraq's Oil Billions. How much money is unaccounted for? And Thea Lawson.
Good morning. We don't actually know how much money is accounted for precisely because this audit has not yet appeared. The auditors did not start work until April, by which time the coalition had already been spending Iraq's money for almost a year, and there were only a few weeks left in order to go through the books. However, Christian Aid has managed to get hold of a copy of the interim audit, which came out, we think it's from the last few weeks. It only covers the actual numbers up until the end of 2003, but its general concerns indicate that the auditors are indeed very concerned that a number of things have not been accounted for properly. This includes the way that Iraq's oil has been sold, not enough records kept of contracts made, why particular contracts were won and others not awarded, and also the auditors are extremely concerned that the information which the coalition possesses about the sole source contracts. Now, these are the controversial contracts that were awarded to large US firms, some of them with links to the Bush administration, and they were awarded without competitive bidding. This information has still not been provided to the auditors, which is extremely concerning.
And this is apart from the U.S. money that's been spent, where already there have been many questions raised about the expenditures. But this is the Iraqi money is not included in any of these revelations that have occurred in the past about Halliburton, the sole source bidding in terms of U.S. money. Right? This is a separate. This is only the Iraqi money.
That's right. This is a completely separate set of money. There are various funds which the coalition in Baghdad has had to draw upon for in issuing reconstruction contracts and getting on with the reconstruction work. There was the $18.4 billion, which was voted by the US Congress, and that's the US funds which you're referring to, and I understand that there has been quite a lot of talk about that in the US. But we have been looking specifically at Iraq's money. Now, this is the only money that Iraq's got. Iraq earns 95% or more of its revenue from oil. This is it. This is Iraq's money. They had no choice in it being handed over to the coalition, and the only grounds on
If I can interrupt you for one second, one thing that your report indicates is that the oil that's being sold from Iraq is not even being metered, so that therefore no one really knows how much oil has been sold?
Yes, this is correct. Now, metering occurs in order to reconcile the amount of oil that is coming out of the ground with the amount that is being sold on at the point when it's moved on into pipelines, tankers and so on to move on to its next destination. Like a lot of Iraq's oil industry, the metering facilities fell into disrepair during the 90s, during the sanctions regime. And one would have thought, given the importance of metering to ensuring transparency of oil revenues, that it would be one of the first things that was put into place before the oil started flowing again. But nearly a year after the CPA began extracting Iraq's oil and selling it on Iraq's behalf, the UN Oversight Board, this board that we were talking about in the report that was set up so late, started complaining to the CPA saying there's no metering. Now, that was only in April.
And Thea Lawson, we're going to have to leave it there. I thank you very much for being with us, one of the authors of Christian Aid's new report, Fueling Suspicion, the Coalition in Iraq's Oil Billions. You can go to our website, get contacts at democracynow.org. Come out tonight if you're in the New York area. Barnes & Noble, as we continue the exception to the ruler's tour at 82nd and Broadway at 7 p.m. Democracy Now! Produced by Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Mike Burke, Jeremy Scahill. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.